This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his Old Testament History, Literature, and Theology course, lecture number 22, on the book of 1 Samuel, Eli, Samuel, and the selection of Saul as the first king of Israel.
The book of 1 Samuel. We had finished the book of Judges, and we said the book of Judges, as the end of the book of Judges, pointed forward through the Levite's concubine to Saul, and we said the book of Ruth kind of points forward to David. And so we're going to see these two kings of Israel are going to come into play in 1 Samuel. And so basically Samuel, Saul, and David are going to be the big characters of the book of 1 Samuel. Now, Samuel, why was Samuel so highly respected? This guy is one of the very highly respected people in the Old Testament. And it turns out, if you look over to Jeremiah chapter 15... let me just read this from the book of Jeremiah. Now, Jeremiah is hundreds and hundreds of years later, but in Jeremiah chapter 15, it starts out like there, this, referring to Samuel. And Jeremiah is probably around 600 B.C. Samuel's is probably about 1100 B.C. So there's, what, about 500 years difference there. Will people remember you for 500 years? 500 years. Here's 500 years later, here's what Jeremiah says about Samuel. And the Lord said to me, even if Moses and Samuel were to stand before me, my heart would not go out to these people. Send them away from my presence. Even if Moses and Samuel were to stand before me, God says, I still wouldn't listen to them. Now, by the way, was Moses a great intercessor for his people in the Old Testament times? Moses in the wilderness. Moses and Samuel are grouped together by Jeremiah here, God's saying, talking to Jeremiah. So this is very interesting, Moses and Samuel. Those are two huge figures, and Samuel is said to be with Moses in this on this level of things. Samuel's going to be the last of the great judges. So Samuel, we're probably down to about 1100. I don't want you to know this date, but about 1100 B.C. The date that we know is what? David is what? David's 1,000. Okay, David's 1,000. And so David's going to be a, David will be a young kid. So Samuel is the last of the great judges. He's also a priest. He's given over to Eli, and he's reared as a priest, and he will be a priest ministering at the tabernacle of God. And he's also a prophet. He speaks for God. What is the great message of the prophet? The great message of the prophet is, thus saith the Lord. The prophet speaks for God. He usually says, repent, and things like that. But the prophet says, thus saith the Lord. And so Samuel is going to be a prophet, priest, and when I say that, prophet, priest, and what? What comes next? Prophet, priest, and king. Doesn't your brain go prophet, priest, and king? But he's prophet, priest, and judge. And why is he a judge? Because there is no what in Israel at this time? There's no king. And so Samuel is going to be the one who is the first kingmaker. God's going to ultimately pick, you know, the first kings. But Samuel, on a human level, Samuel will choose and anoint the first two kings of Israel for God. So Samuel's going to anoint Saul, and then he's going to anoint David. Samuel's going to be involved in that. So this guy is, there's a huge transition taking place in Israel now. This transition from the judge period to the kingship. And the kingship is going to last what? How long will Israel have kings? And he shall reign forever and ever, something like that. And so the kingship is being set up now with Samuel. And Samuel's going to initiate that and going to anoint the first kings of Israel. And the kings are going to go on. Jesus Christ himself is going to be called the son of David in the kingship over Israel. So this is being set up here. So this is really kind of an important point in Israel. Now, did Samuel write the book of Samuel? Did Samuel write the book of Samuel? And the answer is no. Samuel is dead in chapter 28. And from what I've been told, it's pretty hard to write when you're dead. So he was dead in 1 Samuel 28. So the book is about Samuel and not necessarily, written by him. Okay. Now, probably the guy had notes. You know what I'm saying? The guy probably had diaries and journals and things that people who wrote this book might very well have worked from the prophetic record that he had. But as far as writing it, he's dead in chapter 28, so he's not writing beyond that. Now, here's the literary pattern. We had a literary pattern in the book of Judges. Here's the literary pattern for the book of Samuel. It's actually similar. First of all, you've got a demise of an old leader. So there'll be an old leader, and our first leader in the book of Samuel will be Eli. And Eli is going to be the old leader. There'll be demise of the old leader. The old leader is going to go be bad and go away and things. And then secondly, God will select a new leader. And initially, the old leader was Eli, and Samuel will be the new leader. And so the new leader will take over, and there's a succession of leadership and this change of leaders that takes place between, in one case, Eli and Samuel, then from Samuel to Saul, and from Saul to David. And what happens is, and this is important, what does the leader, in 1 Samuel, the leader has to do something. He does it every time. The leader must win a victory, a military victory. So as the new leader is selected by God, the first thing the new leader does is wins a military victory. And this will happen. By the way, David gets anointed king in chapter 16. David is anointed king. Guess what happens in chapter 17? David's anointed in chapter 16. Chapter 17 is about what's David's great victory. Everybody in the room knows it. What's his greatest David's? Goliath. And so he's anointed. And then what's the first thing he's got to do? He's got to win a military victory. And so David defeats Goliath in the next chapter after he's anointed. And so you get this connection between the selection and the deed that he does. Then what happens? The problem is then problems. There's problems with the new leader, and then the new leader becomes, when he has problems, Saul has problems, David has problems, Samuel has problems, then basically the demise of the old leader, and this thing cycles back around. So that's basically how the book works here. Dr. Borgman, who's written a book on David, and actually I've got a lecture posted by Dr. Borgman, notes in the book of Samuel there are all these echoes. In other words, the book of Samuel says the same thing like three different times. And so there are these echoes in the book. And you've got to listen for those echoes between these repetitions that are in the book of Samuel. Repetition is one of the keys to understanding 1 Samuel. And so we'll see that as we go on. But this is the basic structure. Now, who's our first cycle? It's our Samuel cycle. And so let's kind of walk through this. Our first cycle, the demise of the old leader. 1 Samuel chapter 1. Our old leader is Eli. Eli is a priest of the Most High God. Eli is a priest. By the way, where do priests minister at this time? The Jews don't have Jerusalem because Jerusalem won't be captured till the time of David. David will be the one that captures Jerusalem. So they don't have Jerusalem is owned by the Jebusites at this time. So where is the tabernacle set up with Eli? Does anybody remember the name of the place?
Shiloh.
Okay, there's a place called Shiloh that the tabernacle was set up for, I don't know, a couple hundred years at Shiloh, the tabernacle was. And that's, and basically, okay, so Eli is the priest at Shiloh in chapters 1 and 2. Then there's a woman named Hannah. My mother always used to say when she got really angry, she'd say, "So help me, Hannah." And it was, anyway. There's a husband named Elkanah. And he's got two wives. Have we seen this before? A husband with two wives. We've seen this before. Remember Jacob with Rachel and Leah? Here we've got two wives again. One's called Hannah, the other Peninna. Who has all the kids? Peninna has all the kids. Hannah can't have kids. Is that a problem in the ancient world? We've seen this. The story of the barren woman, have we seen this story over and over again? So Hannah, Elkanah has this wife, Hannah. He loves her, but she can't have children. She's heartbroken. She wants to have children. And it says the Lord had closed up her womb. And her rival, Peninnah, was basically, it says, provoking her in order to irritate her. Okay? Now, Hannah's husband, Elkanah, isn't the smartest guy in the world. Not the sharpest knife in the drawer. What happens is, here's what Elkanah says to his wife. His wife is totally distraught. She can't have children. Her rival is egging her on, just irritating the daylights out of her. So Elkanah comes to his wife, and he wants to say something really comforting to her. And this is what he says. Listen to this guy, what he says. Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why don't you eat?" Do you notice this? Do you notice what's going on? She's distraught. How many people, when they get distraught, don't eat? Okay? And he notices she's not eating. Okay, is that one of the signs of depression and things like that? The person doesn't eat. And so he picks up on this. He says, why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? And then he makes this statement. Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? What's the answer to that rhetorical question? Of course not. I want the 10 sons. And so he says, don't I mean more to you, Hannah, than 10 sons? No. And so, you know, you don't ask those kind of questions. Okay, you just don't ask those kind of questions because, you know, anyway, so this guy, I don't know, he's a little off there. You should have known his wife better and stuff. That's a bad question to ask. So Hannah then makes this vow. She comes in chapter 1, verse 11, and she made a vow saying, O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then, check this out, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head. No razor will ever be used on his head. What is she dedicating her son to right from birth? Yeah, this is a Nazarite vow. Is Samuel going to be a Nazarite from birth? Now we've seen, who is the other Nazarite from birth that we know about? Samson. Okay, so here we have Samson. But by the way, is Samuel going to be big and strong? No, no. But he's dedicated to the Lord right from birth. His mother says no razor will come on his head and be used on him. And now here's the problem. Eli, who's the priest, sees her praying to God. And this is to what Eli's reaction is. As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Verse 13 of chapter 1, Hannah was praying in her heart and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk. And he said to her, how long will you keep getting drunk? Get up, get rid of your wine. And Eli rebukes her. Was this woman pouring out her heart to the Lord? And so Eli jumps all over her case and says, you know, you're a drunk woman in here. Get out of here. You know, you're just being drunk and being in the tabernacle of the Lord and stuff. But it's really kind of ironic, isn't it? Because Eli rebukes Hannah. Well, let me just say why this is ironic. Eli rebukes Hannah for being drunk. What were Eli's own kids doing? Were they messing around with women in the front of the tabernacle and stuff? And so my guess is, have you ever seen a parent project the evil of their kids onto other kids? Where the parent projects the evil of his own kids onto other people. And I think what Eli is doing is saying he knows his kids are messing around with these women, doing immoral stuff in the tabernacle area and stuff. And so he thinks that she's one of these immoral women. These women are drunk and getting in trouble in the tabernacle. And so he rebukes her. But it turns out, is she really righteous? Is she more righteous in a certain sense than he is? And so he projects what his own kids are doing on Hannah, and this was wrong. Samuel then, God comes and says, basically, gives Hannah a son. The son's name is Samuel. Samuel is a beautiful name. You guys know this first word. Remember, what does Shema mean? Does anybody remember that? Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, Shema Yisrael, Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, exactly. Hear, so Shema means hear, heard of, and what's the last part of his name? Heard of El. Heard of El, or El listened. Who's El? El is God. God listened. So what's Samuel's name mean? God heard, God listened. God heard her prayer and gave her Samuel. So God listened. It's a beautiful name, Samuel and stuff. God, well, there it is right there. Actually, God listened, okay? And so Samuel is named, and God heard and gave Hannah the son. Hannah then dedicates him to the Lord by giving him over to Eli. By the way, who else made a vow to God and may have delivered over to God their child? Does that sound a little bit like Jephthah? Remember Jephthah made a vow? And then, okay, yeah, okay, whether he burned or whatever. It's interesting, maybe parallel there. Now, Eli's sons, what do we learn about these guys, okay? Eli's sons. Two big problems that they were doing. They were priests under Levi. Eli would be the main high priest type person. His sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were ripping off meat. They were ripping off meat. When people brought sacrifices, did the priest get to eat some of the meat? If it were a purification offering or if it were a sin or guilt offering, the priest got to participate in that. Okay? If it was a whole burnt offering, the priest did not get that because that was wholly burned up to the Lord. But his kids, basically, whenever they saw a sacrifice, they figure, hey, it's steak time, man. We're going to chow down. And so they basically stuck their fork in and took whatever meat they wanted, and they totally defiled God's sacrifice. And all the people knew this, that when they bring their sacrifices to God for their sins, they're offering up, the priests are ripping them off. And so it's basically, it totally like defiled God's sacrificial system, and these guys are doing some really bad stuff. They're also committing immorality with women by the tabernacle. So these women would bring sacrifices, and pretty soon, you know, the guy's trying to get them to go to bed. Okay? And so this was really bad. Now, for you guys, it's even worse than that, because in pagan religions, the Baal worship and the Asherah worship, Baal worship was a fertility god. You guys remember Baal in the Old Testament? Baal was a fertility god. Part of the worship service for Baal worship, part of the worship for Baal worship was that basically a guy would go into the priestess, and the priestess would be housed in the temple, and the guy would go into the priestess. If she conceived and she was fertile, there's all sorts of imagery here. I don't want you to think about the imagery. I want you to think about the ideas and stuff. But basically, if the guy goes in and impregnates the priestess and she is fertile, that meant his land would be fertile. Did you see the similarity? As the guy goes into the priestess of Baal and she is fertile, that meant his land would be fertile. And so basically, it was a fertility rite. And they practice these fertility rites in Israel. By the way, is that pretty immoral? By the way, it's part of the worship of Baal. Is that really gross? Okay? But you see the idea. The guy wanted his land to be fertile, so he would go see the priestess, and there was this kind of sympathetic or symbiotic relationship between what happens with the woman and what happens with his land. Okay? So what you have here is kind of an aping of that same kind of thing in the tabernacle kind of construct with Israel, which was totally against what Jehovah God wanted and stuff. In contrast to Hophni and Phinehas, Eli's sons, you have this wonderful statement in chapter 2, verse 25 and 26. Let me read this statement. And I want you to think of who comes to mind when I read this statement. Okay? Who comes to mind? Eli's sons, however, did not listen to their father's rebuke. They did not listen, to their father's rebuke, for it was the Lord's will to put them to death. And the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and with men. Does anybody remember? Let me just read this again. Who also is this, almost this line said, almost word for word. And the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and with men. Jesus. Yeah. Does anybody remember over in Luke chapter 2, it says Jesus grew in stature and in favor with God and with man? That almost exact same phrase is used of Jesus, is used of Samuel here. So it's kind of interesting. Samuel's a good person, grew in favor with the Lord and with men and stuff. Now, how was Eli as a father? It turns out that Eli, as a father, seems to be a weak man, and he seems to be a weak father. His sons were doing stuff, and he didn't stop his sons from doing them. He didn't stop his sons. And so, basically, his sons are bad. He's a weak father, his bad sons. And I want to look at this kind of father-son relationship thing as it goes on in the book of Samuel. When I was younger, I studied the book of Proverbs. I was a young father. I was in my mid-20s, and I had my first child. And I really didn't know what it was like to be a father. And so I decided that I was going to do my academic work. I was going to study the book of Proverbs. Why did I study Proverbs for most of my life? Because Proverbs is as a father speaks to his children. And so I wanted to be a good father. So I thought, I'm going to be this good father. That will guarantee me that I have good kids, right? If I'm a good father, then my kids turn out right. Because I'm a good father, we have a good home, and the kids turn out right. Okay? And I just want to expose some of that. I was greatly, I needed to have grown up a lot since then. But I want to just point this out. We'll come back to this thing about, but Eli was a weak father and his sons. Now, what about the call of Samuel? The call of Samuel. This story in chapter 3 is a beautiful story. Do any of you guys teach children in like Sunday school? Or you remember Sunday? This is a great Sunday school story, okay? So Samuel's sleeping in his bed. Eli is sleeping as the priest in his bed and things. And all of a sudden, the Lord comes to Samuel at night and says, Shamuel, Shamuel. And Samuel wakes up and says, whoa, Eli called. So he goes trucking into Eli. Eli, what'd you want? What'd you want, Eli? Okay. Eli says, I didn't call you. Go back to bed. Okay. Do kids ever get up at night and kind of when something scares them and run into their parents? Okay. How many times, I don't know, our kids, we had thunder and lightning in Indiana and stuff and tornadoes and stuff. All of a sudden the kids, boom, they're out of their bed, bam. They're all you, and you wake up and your kids are crawling all over you and stuff like that because, you know, they're scared and they want to, anyways. And so then, anyway, so Samuel, then God, Eli sends them back. Samuel, Samuel, Samuel wakes up again, runs into Eli. Eli, what'd you want? Man, I didn't call you. By the way, when you're a parent, are kids going to wake you up in the middle of the night? Yeah, it's part of the game, unless you get some kid that's highly sedated. Or No, don't do that. But some kids, no, seriously, some kids are different. Some kids sleep through the whole night. Other kids will keep you up all night repeatedly. And I wish for you the kind that sleeps through the night. It's quite different. So anyway, finally, the third time, Eli figures it out. And Eli says, man, I'm not calling this kid. It's God calling this kid. So Eli then turns to him in chapter 3. And Eli realized that the Lord was calling the boy, chapter 3, verse 9. So Eli told Samuel, go lie down, and if he calls, you say, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. Do you get the play on words here? What's Samuel's name? Listening. Listening. And so there's like a play on Samuel's name here, okay? Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening, okay? The herd of God one now is listening. Samuel went and laid down his place. The Lord came and stood there calling as other times, Samuel, Samuel. Samuel said, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And the Lord said to Samuel, now this is interesting here. This is heavy. See, God speaking to Samuel. He says, see, I am about to do something in Israel that will make the ears of everyone who hears it tingle. At the time, I will carry out against Eli everything I spoke against his family from beginning to end. For I told him that I would judge his family forever because of the sin he knew about. His sons made themselves contemptible and he failed to restrain them. It's one of the roles of a father to restrain his children. Yeah. Can your parents restrain you? How many of you have snuck and done stuff that your parents had no idea what you did? Okay, he's judged here because he didn't restrain his kids from doing this evil in the presence of the Lord. For I told him that I would judge his family forever because the sin he knew about, his sons made themselves contemptible and he failed to restrain them. Therefore, I swore to the house of Eli, the guilt of Eli's house will never be atoned for by sacrifice or offering. Now, your little boy Samuel, who's rearing you? Who's raising you? Eli is your stepfather. He's the priest. Do you look up to this guy who's rearing you? Samuel looks up to him. He's his hero and things. And now, the next morning, what's the first thing Eli is going to ask? Hey, Samuel, what did God say to you? Would you want to be little boy Samuel telling Eli that God says, basically, Eli, your family's fried, man. It's over. Would you want to be a little boy doing that? By the way, is that the role of a prophet, however? Is that the role of a prophet? And so sure enough, next morning Eli gets up and he says, Samuel answered, here I am. And he says, what is it that he said to you? Down to verse 17, Eli asked, don't hide it from me. God deal with you ever be so severely if you hide anything from me. And so Samuel comes out with it and basically tells him that Eli's family is history because of what he did and stuff. So Eli is rejected, and Eli's two boys, Hophni and Phinehas, are rejected. And God now is selecting a new leader. The new leader is Samuel, and little boy Samuel is called of God. This is the call of, you know, we talk about vocation and the call of God. This is Samuel's call of God. It's really kind of a neat call. Has that kind of little kid feeling. By the way, can little kids relate to this story? It's a great story for Sunday school class and for little kids and stuff, even for adults and stuff. Now, the demise of an old leader. You've got Eli, what happens now? He knows his history and things. But before we get to the picture, I just want to say there's a map coming up here, and I want to kind of lay out the territory and things for this. First of all, do you see Shiloh here? Okay, the Philistines are going to be out here in the plain. Okay, this is the Philistine plain. This is the Mediterranean Sea. The picture's turned sideways, more in a Jewish way of thinking about it. But anyways, here's the Mediterranean Sea. The Philistines are going to be out here. The Jews are in the mountains. Here's Shiloh. Is Shiloh really well protected? This is where the tabernacle of God's going to be. By the way, what's down here? Jerusalem is off about there. Do you see this route that goes right here? This is called the ridge route. It goes from south to north, from down to Jerusalem to Bethlehem to Hebron on down, and stuff comes up. This is called the ridge route. Is Shiloh a little bit off the road? Kind of like Grapevine Road or, you know, Gordon College, just a little off the road, main drag. And so Shiloh. Is Shiloh really well protected by the mountains? The Philistines are down here. They're the Philistines where they have to go all the way up through the mountains to get to Shiloh. So it's very well protected. Shiloh is there. That's where the tabernacle was for a couple hundred years. It was there at Shiloh. Okay. Now what's going to happen is they're going to bring the ark out of Shiloh and they're going to bring it down this road, which still exists till this day. They're going to bring it down to Aphek, and down here in Aphek then, Aphek is where the Philistines are going to be. And they're going to do battle out here on the Philistine plains. But who's going to have the advantage when they fight on the plains? The Philistines. And so the Philistines are actually going to capture the Ark of God here. And this is where Hophni and Phinehas, Eli's kids, are going to die right here at Aphek. There's going to be a battle. And so there's going to be, boom, down here, the Ark is going to be lost. And then they're going to haul the Ark down to the Philistine cities in it. So this is kind of the battle scenario. The Jews are safe up in the hills. They're not safe out on the territory. And so there's going to be a battle there. That's kind of the geography of it. Now, the demise of an old leader. They go back and they're going to fight the Philistines. And so the Ark is going to be captured here and lost to Israel. They bring the Ark out. And when I was younger, I used to think that they were wrong for bringing the Ark out to fight the Philistines. And they may have been wrong and partially. But has Israel ever brought out the Ark to battle before? When we were in the book of Joshua, does anybody remember a battle that they had where the Ark led the way? Yeah. When they walked around Jericho, the Ark led them around Jericho once a day for 7 days, seven times in the seventh day. The Ark led them into battle. So they had the precedence for doing this over in Joshua. And it turns out Saul himself will bring out the Ark and take it out to battle. And so in the book of Samuel itself, they actually do this again with the Ark, taking the Ark into battle. The problem, I think, is this guy idea that you got God in a box. Did anybody ever see that Raiders of the Lost Ark? Okay. And then all of a sudden, you open the Ark, and everybody's face melts down and stuff. It's kind of special effects and stuff, Indiana Jones style and things. So what's going to happen is they bring out the Ark, and it's kind of like they think they've got God in this box. And therefore, God is in this box. If we bring this box out, then God will have to fight for us because God is on our side. We've got God captive in this box. God's in this box, therefore God will be on our side. And what I'm suggesting is God captive to this box? And the answer is no. And I wonder sometimes how many of us, including myself, where we think about God is in the box, but now that God is in the box of our mind, that God is on our side. Can we always be guaranteed that God is on our side? Whose side is God on? Is God on God's side? You know what I'm saying? So we can't manipulate God, and I think we get comfortable. I guess what I'm saying is, I think we build boxes that we put God in our mind. And God, we get comfortable with God in our mind. We think about God in a certain way, and we get comfortable about it. Which is one of the reasons why I like this class, because, you know, everybody's used to the lovey-dovey God who's in, you know, God is up in heaven. He loves everybody, has a wonderful plan for their life. And oh, God just is gracious and good and kind. And then you guys read the Old Testament. And then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, God's doing, whoa, smoke those people, and boom, they all this stuff, the ground opening up, and you say, holy cow, actually, is it a different God from the Old Testament to the New Testament? Or is it the same God? And then all of a sudden, whoa, Maybe it's a different God. And I love this course because it allows you to see God breaks out of the box and doesn't fit into this nice little American lovey-dovey teddy bear that we've got in heaven. And all of a sudden you realize God is a real God. There's a thing called justice. There's a thing called holiness. And these things matter. And there's big things going down. And they aren't all good. God is not always on our side, so to speak. And I think it's a really dangerous thing. So breaking out God out of the box in our mind, I think, you know, we suffer from some of the same ways of thinking. What happens? Eli's sons, the ark is captured in chapter 4, verse 18. Hophni and Phinehas, Eli's two boys, are killed in battle. So the two sons of Eli are killed in battle, and a messenger gets up, and a messenger runs from Aphek all the way up to Shiloh. And Eli is an old man. He's not going into battle, and he's apparently heavy too. They come to Eli, and the messenger tells him this in chapter 4, verse 18. It says, the messenger says, comes, when he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell backward off his chair by the side of the gate. His neck was broken, and he died, for he was an old man and heavy, and had led Israel 40 years. Was Eli really a bad person? I want to say Eli wasn't a bad person. He seems to be weak over his sons. His sons were doing some really bad stuff, and he should have stopped them, and he didn't. He led Israel for 40 years. His sons die? Is that a problem? His sons die? Is that a problem? Should the father always die first before the kids? Is that the natural order? In other words, the father dies first. I faced this a year ago in this very room, in this context and stuff. My son was in Afghanistan. And I gave him lecture after lecture to my son. And I told him who dies first. And I told him the old man dies first, right? So don't go getting any ideas, you know, about being some hero over there and stuff. I want you to come back alive. The old man goes first. That's me, okay, and not him. Because is there something really... How should I say, does it really, really hurt a parent when their child dies? You know what I'm saying? It's like the parent should die first. That's the way it should be. And we really struggled, to be honest with you, really, really struggled with that last year. He came back, now he's back in America, and he's got all his limbs and stuff. Many of his buddies did not come back like that. And many of them didn't come back at all. And, well, they came back, but in a box. And worse than that. But anyway, so it just is interesting here. Eli hears about his sons. There's no big reaction. When he hears that the ark of God is, and he falls over backwards. So the father and the sons die in the same day. And so Eli now is what? Eli's off the scene. Who's going to take over now? Who's ready to take over? Eli's off the scene. His sons are all gone. Well, we got one little boy that we got to get in here first. This guy's name is Ichabod. As soon as I say Ichabod, what's the next word you think of? Ichabod? Crane. Yeah, everybody thinks of Ichabod. Ichabod. It turns out that Phinehas' wife was pregnant when he went off to war. Does this often happen where guys, you know, girl gets pregnant, guy goes off to war, guy gets killed, and now the kid has no parent? I mean, does that happen like here in America, like now? Yes, okay. And so Phinehas goes off. Phinehas is killed. The wife then is having a boy. But in what happens is the mother dies too in the process of childbirth. And by the way, in the ancient world, did women die in childbirth? Was that fairly, I don't want to say it was super common, but it was fairly common. In America now, you realize it's not a problem as much. But in the ancient world, a lot of women died in childbirth. And so she dies in childbirth. And as she's expiring and stuff, the nurse basically says, "Don't despair. You have given birth to a son." And she did not respond or pay any attention. She's dying. And she named the boy Ichabod. 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 Ich means no. Ich means no. Kabod means no kabod. No glory. Okay? The glory is departed. And so she names this kind of the glory is departed. By the way, do you see that there's a kind of a double entendre meaning here as well? The glory is departed. Does she mean that her husband died in battle? Probably, okay? Her husband died in battle. The glory has departed. By the way, has the glory departed in the sense that the ark has been lost to the Philistines? That God's glory has been removed? So it's kind of like a double play on things here. And the glory has been departed, meaning her husband's dead, but it also, the ark has been lost, and that's probably the more significant. When I was a young kid, I went to a real conservative, fundamentalistic Baptist church. And have you ever been in a church where they kick out the pastor and things, and it's Anyway, so they're in the process of kicking out this pastor, and it's getting pretty tense. And so the pastor then gets a sermon. He pulls everybody out of the church. There's like 300 people in the church and all the people out on the street in the church. And he stands in front of them, and he basically says, they're going to write Ichabod over this church in 10 years. They're going to write Ichabod over this church. Now, what did he mean by that? The glory is departed. And he basically was saying the demise of this church. You kick me out, this whole church is going to fall because I am the great, you know. And it was probably good that they got rid of him. But anyways, but what I'm saying is that really arrogant? They're going to write Ichabod over this church. I mean, you can just see the arrogance coming through. I mean, it's this, you know, whether the church was right or wrong, actually, I think they were probably right in doing what they did. But anyways, just that phrase, Ichabod, the glory is departed kind of thing. Now, what happens? The Philistines get the ark. What's the deal with the ark? Well, there's going to be a problem with the ark. And I want to introduce now, if I said the word Pentapolis to you, this is Greek word, Pentapolis. Penta means what? Five, like Pentagon. Penta means five. Polis means what? Pentapolis. Polis means what? City. Okay, so you have a Pentapolis are the five cities. And these are the five cities of the Philistines. And these are famous places. Even till this day, these are famous. If I point to this one here, Gaza, you've all heard of Gaza, the Gaza Strip down that Israel has so much, there's so much embattlement with Israel till this day. Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, Gaza, and Ekron. These are the five famous Philistine cities. And what I want to do is just show you a map. By the way, can you guys download these maps on PowerPoint, right? So download the stuff so you don't have to kind of pay all that much, you know, to get it exactly right. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Joppa is where Tel Aviv is today. So this is Tel Aviv. Our first place is Ekron. The battle took place here at Aphek. This is where the ark was captured. They came down here to Aphek. The Philistines captured the ark. They took the ark over this direction to the five Philistine cities. Ekron is one city. Gath is next to it. By the way, you all know somebody by name from Gath. He was a real big guy. Goliath of Gath. Goliath was from Gath, and that's where Goliath's hometown was. Okay, so Goliath of Gath, Ekron, these are the two. Notice that these are closer to Israel toward the mountains. They're still on the plains, but they're closer to the mountains. These are here. Then there's three out on the coast. There's three out, two internal and three out on the coast. The first one is Ashdod. Ashdod is here. There's some sand going through here. And Ashkelon. Now, when you look where Ashkelon is, where is Ashkelon? Is it right on the coast? Ashkelon, right on the coast here. What do you know about the Mediterranean Sea? Is the Mediterranean Sea, or really, if you go to Israel, is this where you want to go swimming? Ashkelon. Beautiful white beaches. The water is about 72 degrees. It's not like New England. You don't get used to the water. You don't have to get used to it. You walk in, and it's like perfect temperature. And the waves are coming in, and you can body surf and stuff. Beautiful sand beach and things. And by the way, this is also the Boston area, Ashkelon. Because Harvard University has excavated Philistine remains here for a ton of years, okay, with Stager. Some of the guys down at Harvard have excavated for a long period of time at Ashkelon. And that's Harvard, that's Boston, so it kind of makes you homesick. The only problem is Harvard, I think my last recollections on Ashkelon was that Harvard bailed out of it. And I think some college east of, or west of Chicago picked it up. Some school, I don't like to say their name, but it's just, it's kind of like Wheaton College, I think John Monson. Wheaton College is now took over from Harvard and is excavating there at Ashkelon. So that's a really, if you want a beautiful place on the coast to swim, the only thing is you got to watch out for missiles from Gaza. But other than that, that's a different story. Sorry. But anyways, Gaza's down here. Do you see? So it's Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, three on the coast. What comes right up through here? And why were the Philistines so brilliant for putting their cities along here? Because what's coming up this road here? This road goes down to where? What's down here, south of there? Egypt. Is Egypt the breadbasket of the ancient world? Egypt is going to be sending all their goods up to Mesopotamia, right? They're going to be coming right up this road. When you've got cities on this road, question, does that mean money? Yeah, these, they're going to, in other words, people shift, ship things. Any guys from New York? You got it in New York, you put a toll booth, right? Toll booth, you make money, okay? And so what they've got is toll booths coming up here, and they're going to make the Philistines, in other words, are the Philistines going to make a ton of money through trade, largely, because anything coming out of Egypt is going to come right up. This is called the Via Maris, or the Coastal Highway. This Coastal Highway, this is Route 95. This is Route 95, comes right up here, major road up into Mesopotamia. And so the Philistines are right on that. So they're going to benefit from all the stuff, all the trade going back and forth between Mesopotamia and Egypt. The Philistines cash in. So it's pretty, they're in a pretty good state. Whenever I see Gaza too, I remember I had a conversation with a Jewish fellow, and he told me to go to Gaza. And I was in Jerusalem, and I could never figure out why he told me to go to Gaza. He said, Lech La'aza. They don't say G, they go, Lech La'aza. Go to Gaza. And I was trying to figure out, I told the guy, I don't want to go to Gaza, I'm in Jerusalem, why would I want to go to Gaza and stuff? And so then I asked around, I said, it was really odd, the guy told me to go to Gaza, but what's that? Gaza is considered a really, really hot place, and the guy wasn't really telling me to go to physical Gaza, he was telling me to go to another place that's very, very hot. And so he was telling me, and I had no clue, I'm trying to understand, what's he mean by Gaza? I don't want to go to Gaza. He was telling me to go to... let me use another word, like Sheol. I mean, like he was telling me to go to in English would be a, you know, bad place, okay? But they say Gaza to do that, okay? It's like a euphemism. You don't want to tell somebody where to go, so you tell them to go to Gaza. But does every language have like idioms like that? You know, I'm saying that the people know what they mean, but if you're outsider, you're trying to figure out, well, what about the city of Gaza, you know, and stuff? Has nothing to do with Gaza. The guy just told you to go to Sheol. So anyways, okay. Okay, Philistines and the Ark. So the Philistines capture the Ark. This is in chapters 4, 5, 6, thereabouts. And they bring the Ark into their city, and they set the Ark in front of this god Dagon. Okay, Dagon is believed to be, he originally used to teach this as a fish god but because of the word, but that's not correct. It's probably more grain or fertility, grain god or fertility god. But the god's made out of stone. They put the ark in front of this god. What happens to this god? Boom. God falls over, knocked him down. So what the people do, they come in and hear their god has fallen down, almost, you know, prostrate in front of the ark. So they pick up their god again. You can see him putting some nails in the god's feet to make sure he stands up straight. So, you know, do you get the irony of people having to set up their god? So he sets up their god. Then what happens? They come in the next day. What happens? The god has fallen over now, and it falls so hard, man, the head falls off, and the hands that were probably out like this, they get busted off. And so all you got is this torso of this god because the rock has been busted off, fallen down, kind of in front of God, almost in a worshipful position in front of the ark. And so what happens with the ark? Well, the ark, now there's other problems that come with the ark, okay, the plagues. And so wherever the ark is taken, people start dying from a plague. And the Philistines start dying from city to city. And so what they start doing is shipping the ark, you know, UPS. They UPS it from one city to the next. And then wherever it goes, man, people are dying and things. And so finally the Philistines say, we got to get rid of this ark. It's going to kill us. And so the Philistines, basically, how are we going to return the ark? And so in chapter 6, verse 4, the Philistines ask, what guilt offering should we send to him? And they replied, 5 golden tumors, 5 golden rats, and up. Anyways, according to the number of the Philistine rulers. In other words, 5. Why 5 golden tumors? Why 5 golden rats? There's 5 rulers of the 5 cities of the Pentapolis. And so they each chip in a golden rat and a golden tumor. By the way, do you also remember what they did with the calves? They took cows that had calves. They hooked the calves up to the cart that was going to be pulling the ark. Normally, calves will do what? If you got the mother cows behind, where will the calves go? Will the calves go back to their mother? Yeah. And the Philistines said, we'll just see if this is really from God or not. If those calves go up the hill to Jerusalem, you know, up toward Jerusalem, up toward the hills, to back to the Jews, then we'll know it's of God. But if the cart turns around, then we'll know it's no big deal. Guess what happens with those calves? Shoom, straight up to Beit Shemesh and right up into Israel territory. And so then they sacrifice those calves to the Lord. But why the golden tumors and why the golden golden tumors and the golden rats? It's believed that This is what's called sympathetic magic. Sympathetic magic. People believe rats and tumors. Rats and tumors, what do you associate that with? Rats and tumors. Yeah, bubonic plague, black plague, okay? And so it's believed that they made models of the tumors that were killing them, and they figured out that it was done by rats, and so they make these models and send the models away. And if you send the models away, that means that the disease will go away. It's kind of like, did any guys like read anything on voodoo where you take a doll and you stick a doll with needles and this doll represents this person, and if you know, do something bad to the doll, it happens to the real person? Do you guys ever, that kind of thing? And so I think this is the same thing. You know, send the five tumors away made out of gold and stuff, honoring their god and stuff, send the rats away and the disease will leave us. And so the ark does go away and the five Philistine cities, this sympathetic magic kind of thing. Now, Israel gets the ark back. Now, Samuel now, Eli is dead, Hophni and Phinehas are dead. Samuel takes over. Samuel has got a, what's the first thing he's got to do as a new leader? Samuel's got to win a victory. And so in chapter 7, Samuel takes over. He wins his first victory at a place called Ebenezer. Ebenezer. He sets up a stone, Ebenezer. Can anybody see the word Etzer? Does anybody remember we talked about Etzer before? When did we say that? Does anybody remember back in Genesis, Eve would be Adam's Etzer, helper? This stone of help, who is Israel's stone of help? God. God is Ebenezer. So Samuel sets up this stone and basically honoring God for having delivered in Ebenezer. And Samuel here, it's really cool. Then Samuel said, "Assemble all Israel to Mizpah, and I will intercede to the Lord for you." And so they fasted and they confessed, "We have sinned against the Lord." Is Samuel a good leader? He gets his people to confess before they fight. And then they said to Samuel, verse 8 of chapter 7, "Do not stop crying out to the Lord our God for us, that he may rescue us from the hands of the Philistines." So they're going out to battle. Samuel is going to be in prayer while they go out to battle. He's going to intercede for them. Who's that almost like? They go out to battle, he intercedes to God. What does that remind you of? Who would that? Yeah, does anybody remember Moses and kind of a similar structure? Moses interceding for the people and that kind of stuff. Ebenezer. Now this brings up a problem, however. If you go from chapter 7, verse 12, about Ebenezer, where it tells about how Samuel names the place Ebenezer, there's a problem. Because back in chapter 5, two chapters earlier, it says, after the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. They took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And you say, well, wait a minute, Hildebrand. Let's suppose I'm a Bible critic. And a Bible critic says, wait a minute, you got a contradiction in the Bible here. The Bible says that Samuel named it in chapter 7, verse 12, was when Samuel named that place Ebenezer. But here you are back two chapters earlier, which is probably, you know, quite a bit earlier, years earlier, and it's called Ebenezer back here in chapter 5, verse 1. That's not right. It wasn't named Ebenezer in chapter 5. You have to wait till chapter 7, verse 12, till Samuel names it Ebenezer. And so that's a contradiction in the Bible. And basically, this is an error in the Bible, okay? And this is what critics would point out. It's named in chapter 7, verse 12, but yet the name Ebenezer was used two chapters earlier. Obviously, the historians got mixed up. The historian got mixed up, and it's a contradiction. It's an error in the Bible. Do you know what an anachronism is? Chronism. Can you see chronism there? Chronism. Does anybody do Greek? Chronos? Time. Okay, chronology. You guys would say chronology, time. Anachronology means it's out of sync. Okay, it's out of time. It's out of time. And this is what you call an anachronism. When is the book of Samuel written? Is Samuel written much later? Samuel's dead in chapter 28, so it's written after the lifetime of Samuel. It's written later. And what you have happening here is the person who's writing the book looking back, and does he call that place Ebenezer because that's what everybody in his day calls it, Ebenezer. So it would be like this. If I said to you, the witches, remember we had the witch burnings in Salem, Massachusetts. Okay, the witch burnings. 1690-something, 1690s. Okay? And I said to you, and the witches were taken up to Danvers. Now, do you guys all know where Danvers is, Liberty Tree Mall? Okay, and I said, Danvers. Everybody would know where that is. Question, did I just make a contradiction? Yeah. Was, when the witches were taken up there, was that called Danvers at that time? No. But if I said Salem Village to you, how many would know Salem Village? Almost nobody. So what I do is I call it by a present name just so you guys know where it is. Is that the way history is written all the time? You don't call it by the original name. If you said Salem Village, nobody know what it is. So what I'm saying is, this isn't a contradiction. This is just a guy who's writing later. He calls it, and everybody in his day calls Ebenezer, Ebenezer. And then he narrates how Ebenezer got its name later, but he uses the term earlier. Now, is that a big contradiction? Do we do that all the time? Yeah, so it's no big deal, okay? No big deal. But critics get on this stuff and they say, oh, see, there's a contradiction in the Bible. It wasn't named till chapter 7, but it's used back chapters 4 and 5, as a matter of fact. And you say, you know, chill out. I mean, if that's the only contradiction you got to find, you're in trouble, you know? So anachronism, some of the things, when a guy's writing later, he's going to use the names and stuff that he's familiar with. He's going to put those back in the narrative. So, okay. Now, what's the problem? Samuel wins his first victory, but now Samuel himself has a problem. And in chapter 8, verse 3, it says, let me start with 8:1. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges of Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abiah, and they were served at Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They accepted bribes, and they perverted justice. What was a judge not to do? Was a judge to establish justice? Yes. And the other thing a judge was not to do was to accept what? Bribes. Money and justice were not to be connected. His sons pervert justice rather than establishing it. They pervert justice, and they accept bribes. So his sons, he's the last big judge. He tries to make his sons. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said, Samuel, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as the other nations have. Why does Israel call for a king? They call for a king because Samuel's kids are no good. Samuel's kids are perverting justice and taking bribes. The people look at his sons and say, Samuel, you're a great guy, Samuel. Nothing against you. You're a godly person. You're a good person. Your kids are all messed up. We need a king to rule over us. And so they call for a king. So that's how kingship gets introduced into Israel. This Israel's calling because of the failure of Samuel's sons. Now, on fathers and sons, let's do a little review here. Was Eli a fairly godly person himself? Eli seems to be a godly person himself. I want to put a plus or minus there. He should have restrained his sons, but Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, turn out evil, so evil that God takes them out. So Eli, not a terrible person, good person in many ways, but his sons are evil and things. Samuel, is Samuel a good godly person all the days of his life? Samuel is a winner. Samuel is a winner, and yet his sons turn out terribly. Okay, they accept bribes, they pervert justice. So is it possible to be a good father, a good person, and have your kids turn out bad? Okay, I thought that if I were the ideal person, then my kids would turn out wonderfully, that the parents, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, the kids would turn out well and things. Is that true? What about this guy, Saul? I'm going to try to show you that Saul is a jerk, okay, to put it bluntly. Saul has got major problems. This guy is a jerk. Saul has got major problems. He tries to kill David repeatedly. This guy is against God in so many ways and stuff. But tell me about Saul's son, Jonathan. Tell me about Saul's son, Jonathan. Is this guy a gold mine? When I was looking for guys to marry my daughters in this arranged marriage I had in my head, I was looking for guys like Jonathan, and I was hoping that my daughters would meet somebody like Jonathan, because this guy is... Jonathan was whose best friend, by the way? David's best friend. Jonathan, David, tight. Likes attract likes and stuff, and Jonathan's just a good person. Is Jonathan better than his father? His father's got all sorts of problems trying to kill people and David and stuff like that. Jonathan's just a gem. Jonathan's a gem. So here you got a bad father. Is it possible to have a bad father and the kid turns out great? Yeah. Yeah. This is. Now what about David? David, what's the problem? Is David the man after God's own heart? David's the man after God's own heart, but David, you know, David had a problem with Bathsheba, Uriah, okay, so David's not perfect in things, but David has one son, Solomon. The Solomon turns out to be the what? The Einstein of the ancient, you know, Israel. He's the wisest man that ever lived kind of thing. Solomon, Shlomo. And then, so David has a winner of a son, but what about Absalom, David's other son? David's other son, Absalom, tried to kill who? Or whom? Well, actually, you guys beat me to it. Yeah, he kills his other brother, and then after that, after he gets done trying, and actually he does kill his brother, Amnon, but then he tries to kill what? Absalom tries to kill David, his own father. Freud was right, okay? Tries to kill his father. Okay, but Absalom tries to kill his father. Okay, so Absalom was really bad. My conclusion to this is, does each generation have to come to know God for themselves? Does each generation have to come to know God for themselves? I can know God in my family. The question, can my family, can my children throw God away? Does each generation have to come and kind of become its own person, its own way of doing things? My son and I were just discussing this the other night. He warned me, he said, "Dad, when my generation gets in the positions of power," he says, "you better fear for your life." Okay? And he was real serious. I thought, chill out. You guys will mature. You know, your generation will mature just like, I hope. But he's really very negative and does not, anyways, yeah, Helena.
It just reminded me of something my mother always says. God has kids. He doesn't have grandkids. So
yeah,
like your relationship with God is your individual relationship.
Okay, I'm going to repeat that just because this is so good. I need to get it on this tape and stuff. He says, God has kids. He has no grandkids. And so each generation is, you know, how did you say that? You said it better than that. God has what?
Kids. I said the same thing.
Okay, God has kids. He doesn't have grandkids. And I really agree with that. And it's just, I don't know. So every generation has to own God for themselves and come to know God for themselves. And it's really important. Now, they say we want a king. Was it wrong for Israel in chapter 8 and following to ask for Samuel, to ask for a king like the other nations? I was taught that Israel was wrong because they were trying to be like the other nations, and so they're just trying to fit in and compromise and be just like the other nations and stuff, and that this was wrong for them to ask for that. However, that's wrong. That's wrong. Moses, back in Deuteronomy chapter 17, Moses, at the end of Moses' life, he's writing the book of Deuteronomy, Moses says, "You will have a king like the other nations," and he uses those very same, exact same words, "you will have a king just like the other nations." Is all from Deuteronomy then moving through Joshua, through Judges, expecting this king to come? Moses told them they would have a king. Is Israel to have a king? Ultimately, does Israel, the whole kingship thing is moving toward whom? Who is the ultimate king of Israel? David. And David moves on to whom? Jesus, who is the what? Son of David, King of Israel. And he shall reign for ever and ever. Okay. And he shall reign forever and ever. So the whole kingship thing is moving to David, to Jesus Christ, and the rule of Christ over Israel and over the world forever. So the notion of this establishing of this kingship, is this in God's plan? Is this something wrong that Israel has asked for a king? No. Yeah. 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 Okay. No, I don't remember. Yeah, I don't know. You'll have to pull the reference up on that and things. But Moses said that they would have a king like the other nations. And Samuel, now they're requesting a king like the other nations, just like Moses said. Now, I agree with you that they're doing it for the wrong motives, probably. But the quote is, in other words, that they were to expect a king, they were to expect a prophet like Moses, and Deuteronomy 18, a prophet. Now, Israel had priests. Did the other nations have priests? Israel had priests, the other nations had priests. So they had priests like the other nations. Did the other nations have prophets? We've seen Balaam and some of the other prophets. The other nations had prophets. Israel had prophets as well, like the other nations. Did the other nations have judges, like the other nations? Israel had judges, like the other nations. And so for them to expect a king like the other nations, Moses told them they would have a king like the other nations. The problem needs to be established correctly. The problem was not that they wanted a king like the other nations. This is the problem. The problem was who was Israel's king at this time? The king at this time was God. And so by calling for a king like the other nations, the problem was not that they called for a king because God told them they were to expect one. The problem was they were calling for another king in lieu of God, in rejection of God. Does God have feelings? Does God have feelings? I want to read a verse here. Did God's feelings get hurt? Did God's feeling get her? Check this out. Chapter 8, verse 7. Start with verse 6. And when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. So Samuel, by the way, Samuel hurt. His kids weren't good, right? His kids were bad. So they come and say, "Hey, Samuel, we don't want your kids. We want a king." Is that going to hurt Samuel? Samuel's going to feel what? Rejection? He's rejecting his family and stuff. So Samuel goes to pray to the Lord. And here's how the Lord responds. Check this out. It's beautiful. And the Lord told him, "Listen to all the people are saying to you. It is not you, Samuel, they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king." That's the issue. Should Samuel feel rejected? God's saying, "Samuel, don't feel rejection. It's not you they're rejecting. It's me." That's a pretty strong statement from God, realizing that his people don't want him to be king anymore. Okay? And that, I think, is the issue. And so it's a beautiful verse there. And you get to kind of see into the inside of God. Now, they're going to go out and make a king. Who's the first king they're going to get? Saul. Okay? Saul comes out of in the Ramah area up there. And what's Saul doing? In chapter 9, Saul's out chasing his father's... Does anybody remember that? Chasing his father's donkeys, right? And he's looking for his father's donkeys on the hills. And he's roaming the hills trying to find these donkeys. And finally, a servant says, "Hey, man, it's getting late. We've been out for a long time. We got to find these donkeys and stuff." And the guy says, "Well, I know that there's a seer here that we can basically go to, and the seer will tell us where the donkeys are, and then we can find the donkeys." And so in chapter 9, verse 9, you get the statement. It says, "The servant said to him again, 'Look,' he said, 'I have a quarter of shekel of silver, and I will give it to the man of God so that he can tell us what way to take.' Formerly in Israel, if a man went to inquire of God, he would say, 'Come, let us go to the seer.'" This is that word seer is really important. Roeh. "Let's go to the roeh, the seer. Because the prophet, the Navi, the prophet of today, used to be called a seer." Now, what's going on with that verse? Let me just kind of develop that a little bit, okay? He said, what we call today a Navi, a prophet, back in those days when Saul was running around the hills chasing his father's donkeys, was called a seer. What does that tell us about the date of writing of the book of 1 Samuel? Okay, in the book of Joshua, was the events of Joshua, the crossing of the Jordan River, the taking of the walls of Jericho down and stuff, were the events of Joshua happen here, were they recorded almost immediately? And they are there till this day. Who is alive till this day when the book of Joshua was actually written? Rahab the harlot. And Joshua says, "Hey, you don't believe me, go ask her. She's still alive. You can confirm everything I've written down here. Rahab the harlot and many of the people that crossed the Jordan River, they're still alive. Talk to them." So the events, historical events were here, and the writing was right next to it. Within that generation, it was written down within the same generation. Now, 1 Samuel. Question. Were things written down immediately? Did Samuel probably take notes? And did Samuel probably have a diary, annals of Samuel, something like that? Yes, probably did. But was this thing written down so much later that the language had actually changed? That the prophet of today used to be called a seer? Does language change over time? But by the way, does it take time for language to change? So what I'm suggesting is here, the events of 1 Samuel are here, but the writing of the book is much later. Okay? Now, by the way, sometimes did the events happen and they were written down immediately. Here, is it clear that the language had time to change? Does the English language change? I ask how many of you, if I said to you the word cassette, how many would know what a cassette is, okay? Let me go back a generation. If I said to you the word record, do you guys like a record? Like a real record? Like with the thing? Oh, is there? Okay. So you guys know what a record is, okay? But I guess let me go in the future. Let me go in the future then. Is it possible your children will not know what a CD or a DVD is? Is it possible that, no, seriously, your children will not know what a CD or DVD is? Because what? Everything's going on the cloud now, right? And so basically CDs, DVDs, they're becoming irrelevant, really. And so, I mean, you've got a couple of years before this actually pans out, but these things are going to be gone, okay? Okay, let me get out of that. So anyway, so all I'm saying is the events happened here, but apparently the language had changed, so that a seer of then is called a prophet now. The language had actually changed. And the writer of Samuel comments about it and says the roe, the seer, is now called a prophet. The language had changed so much. Now, the focus on Saul is what? On Saul's height. He's a head taller than everybody else. And so basically Samuel says, hey, Saul, don't worry about it. Your father's donkeys have been found. Don't worry about it. You to whom all of Israel looks. And Saul says, wait a minute. I can't be king. He says, I'm from the what? I'm from the tribe of Benjamin. And the tribe of Benjamin is the least tribe of Israel. And my clan is the least of Benjamin. By the way, did everybody know why Benjamin was the least tribe of Israel? Because they were almost wiped out because of the evil and stuff. So Saul comes on like that and says these kinds of things that he's not fit to be things. And so it sounds like in chapter 9, verse 21, let me just read that. Saul answered, but am I not a Benjamite from the smallest tribe of Israel? And is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me that I'm going to be king? It sounds like humility. How many humble people have you really known in your life? By the way, how many arrogant or proud people? Proud and arrogance. Can you see pride and arrogance just like that? Is pride and arrogance really easy to see? I think of a proud person I know. He actually is a senator in terms of Massachusetts and stuff. My daughter used to work for a senator up in New Hampshire. And the senator from Massachusetts would come in. And if the senator ever got egg on his face, he would come into the people that work for him and treat them like dirt. Your job is to make me look good. And I look bad now, and so you are fired. And he'd ream them out, just really ream them out. Because why? His face was tarnished because, you know, these people. Okay? Is that a sign of arrogance? You're my slaves to make me look good and stuff. My daughter worked for a senator up in New Hampshire. There was about 10 people working in this office or so. And in the New Hampshire office, the senator was totally humiliated. One of the girls in the office set it up so that he was totally blindsided and made look like a fool. And he had egg all over his face. And everybody in the office knew this girl really messed up big time. Now, the senator comes into the office, and he's coming to visit the office, the big senator. He walks in, question, is there like fear and trembling? Everybody's working on their computers looking like that with their eyes over to see what he's going to do. The senator in New Hampshire walks up to the girl's desk who did this. And by the way, at this point, it's like, I know I made a really bad mistake. And, you know, he walks up to the girl's desk and everybody is ready for the hammer to come down this poor girl's head because she really did mess up. You know what he did? Comes up to her desk, walks directly up to her, cracks a joke, and says, you know, we all make mistakes at certain points in our life and stuff. Just don't let it happen again. Okay, question. Was that humility? the big senator, could he have squashed her and said, you made me really look bad, and he could have really come down hammer. Was he a gentle, was that something for him to do that and to say we all make mistakes and to put it in that context so she could relax and realize, you know, I want to say that guy was humble, okay? How do you tell a difference between arrogance and humility? Here's a check. If you give somebody who's proud power, how do they use it? If you give somebody that's humble power, how do they use it? Will a proud person use power very differently than a humble person will? Will a humble person use it for the benefit of others? Will a proud person use it to what? Bolster themselves. I always kind of get a kick. Sometimes students come up to me and say, oh, Professor Hildebrand, you're so humble and all this kind of stuff. And it's just wonderful. And then I go home and talk to my wife. My wife says, you are the most arrogant person I know. Stuff like this. So then what do? Do I believe my wife or the students? Well, of course, the students. You know, she doesn't know what's going on in the real world and stuff. So, question, who's right? Yeah, my wife. The honest truth is my wife. She knows me. She knows me. She reads me. She's known me for 36, 7, 8, no longer than that, years, okay? So she knows me like a book. So do I need to listen to what she's saying? Easy to spot in someone else, very difficult to spot in yourself. Is it possible that you've known humble people that you've just passed by and didn't even realize them because they're humble and just went right on by? Now you say, well, what about Saul? Saul seems to be humble. I'm from the least tribe of Benjamin and things. Is this real humility or is this insecurity? Insecurity and humility look alike. Insecurity and humility can look alike externally. How do you tell the difference between insecurity and humility? If you give an insecure person power, how will they use it? To bolster themselves. If you give a humble person power, others. Question, was Saul insecure or was he humble? How did he use power? Did he use power to go after David? Did he use power to go after the priest of Nob? Did Saul was an insecure person. Saul was an insecure person. And so don't be fooled by this pseudo-humility. It was really insecurity that I believe. Okay? Now, the Spirit of God comes on Saul. The Spirit of God comes on Saul, chapter 10, verse 10. The Spirit comes on him, and what does he do? He starts prophesying. It says, and when they arrived at Gibeah, a procession of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came on him in power, and he joined in their prophesying. When all those who had formerly known him saw him prophesying with the prophets, they asked each other, is Saul among the prophets? Is Saul among the prophets? So the Spirit comes on him. Was there the Spirit of God in the Old Testament? Yes, the Spirit of God was in the Old Testament, and his works were usually endowing people like kings and prophets with special gifts. Actually, when the Spirit of God came on Samson, what did the Spirit do for him? Made him big and strong, okay? So the Spirit comes on and endows him with gifts in the Old Testament. When I was younger, I thought, did the Spirit of God come down at Acts chapter 2 is when the Spirit kind of came down on the earth in Acts chapter 2 at Pentecost? No, the Spirit is in the Old Testament. The Spirit is in the Old Testament gifting various people, kings, prophets, people, with special gifts in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, the Spirit is still here. The Spirit is still here, but the work of the Spirit in the New Testament is different. In the New Testament, the Spirit binds the body of Christ together so that Jews and Gentiles can be one body. And so the work of the Holy Spirit in the New Testament, in this Acts chapter 2 context, is binding the body of Christ together. And so it's just a matter of changing the work of the Spirit. Now, Saul is basically made king three times, okay? Saul is basically made king three times. And here, the second time, they go up to Mizpah, and this is going to be him publicly being anointed in front of all Israel. The first one, at Ramah with Samuel, is a private anointing, okay? A private selecting of Saul as king. Samuel and Saul on a personal level in a private context of a home. Now at Mizpah, Saul is put out before all the people. And when they go to call Saul, where is Saul? Saul's hiding in the baggage. He's scared to death. They drag his tail out of there. You can see somebody going over and grabbing him by his belt and pulling him out of the baggage. And he stands up and he's a head taller than everybody else. By the way, did they want somebody big and strong? They wanted somebody big and strong to lead them into war. And so Saul, God picks this tallest, strongest kind of guy and drags him out of the baggage to make him king and things. Saul then has to do what? As a new leader, he has to do what? Win a victory. He goes over to Jabesh-Gilead and he defeats the Ammonites. Where is Jabesh-Gilead? It's over here in Jordan. If this is Israel, Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, Jabesh-Gilead's over here. Did anybody make a connection with Jabesh-Gilead? This is Saul's first victory over the Ammonites at Jabesh-Gilead. Does anybody remember Jabesh-Gilead from anything? This is like a $1 million question. Last period, nobody got it. When the Benjamites were down to 600 guys and all the Benjamites were killed, where did they get wives for the Benjamites? Jabesh-Gilead. Is it likely that Saul's grandmother or so came from Jabesh-Gilead and that he is going back defending Jabesh-Gilead because that's where his family roots are from through his mother? Okay, now I don't know that. I'm just suggesting that, but it makes very good sense. Why does he go after Jabesh-Gilead and protect them? So Saul protects Jabesh-Gilead. And the third time there's a covenant thing, covenant renewal at Gilgal. Now this is really important in Gilgal. They go down to Gilgal. Is Gilgal a holy place? Gilgal's down by Jericho. Remember they crossed the Jordan River? They went to Gilgal before, and they, remember the manna stopped? They circumcised, and they had their third Passover there at Gilgal. And so now, they go to Gilgal, bless you, and they renew the covenant there. Now this is a really important concept. When Moses is passing succession onto Joshua, what does Moses do? Moses writes the book of Deuteronomy as a covenant renewal, saying that the power is going to be transferred from Moses to Joshua. And as that power succession goes from Joshua to Moses, they need to recommit themselves to God through a renewal of the covenant. At the end of the book of Joshua, Joshua is going to pass it on to the judges. At the end of the book of Joshua, guess what you have another in Joshua 24? You have a covenant renewal ceremony. Whereas Joshua is fading off, he passes on this generation. They renew themselves to the covenant. Now, what's happening? Samuel, the last of the judges, is moving now over to the kingship. And as there's a succession between the judges to this new king, there's a renewal of the covenant at Gilgal. A new renewal of the relationship. By the way, is this college going through a succession transition right now? From Judd Carlberg, president for many, many, many years, to Michael Lindsay, new president. Whenever there's a transition of power, should that be the time where there's a recommitment to God and one's relationship to God? And indeed, this place. And so this is kind of interesting with the renewal covenant there. Now, Samuel responds, and his response here is really interesting. Chapter 12, verse 3. And Samuel says, "Here I stand, testify to me in the presence of the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I cheated?" Samuel stands up in front of all the people and he says, "Hey, have I stolen any of your oxen? Have I taken anything from you? Have I cheated anybody in this whole place?" And they all say, "No, Samuel, you've been a good person." Is that a pretty good commentary on Samuel? And then Samuel says this at the end of chapter 12, there down verse 23. He says, "As for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by failing to pray for you. And I will teach you in the way that is good and right." Did Samuel see it as a sin if he did not pray for those people? He said, I'm out of power now. I'm out of power. The new king's going to take over. But I need to pray for you. How many of you pray for your leaders? How many of you pray for Michael Lindsay as he leads this institution and stuff? I know I set up a thing when I walk into Frost Hall, I forget everything and things. So I make little markers in life. So when I walk through the door at Frost, I remember to pray for basically three people. Michael Lindsay, actually a little bit more than that, but Dan Tyman is another one of my heroes. And then there's a guy named Bruce Webb. He's been a faculty member here for over 30 years, and Bruce has got stage 4 cancer. You know what that means, stage 4? It means he's history. And I pray for Bruce as I go in there and stuff. And as a matter of fact, just before I come over to teach class, guess who I talk to? Bruce Webb. You need to pray for people. And so you need to have triggers. Samuel says, "Far be it from me to sin and not to pray for you." And so praying for others is really, really important. And Samuel did that role. Now, Let's just do this in about 2 minutes. What does 1 Samuel 13:1 go? And this is something you can take home to your parents. I want to just make them, show them how smart you are and cause them trouble so they get really mad at Gordon. Okay. King James Version. Saul reigned 1 year and then he reigned 2 years over Israel. Does anybody remember we started the semester with this? And then do you remember the old NASB says Saul was 40 years old and he reigned 32 years over Israel. Is that different than the King James Version? The King James Version, Saul was 1 year, reigned 1 year, and then he reigned 2 years over Israel. By the way, does the King James got to be wrong? Is that really kind of a dumb verse? Saul reigned 1 year, and then he reigned 2 years. And then he reigned three, and then he reigned four. You know, it doesn't, you know. The NIV goes the other way. So, NIV and the NLT, by the way, the NIV and the NLT, go Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 42 years over Israel. Is this different than this? The NASB has 40 and 32 years. This says he was 32 years and reigned 42 years. Okay, 30 years, 42. And here is the RSV, the NRSV, and the ESV. The ESV is basically, the ESV is an ape of the RSV, unfortunately. And so Saul was dot, dot, dot years old and reigned dot, dot, dot years. What is the RSV, NRSV, and the ESV telling you? Is the number gone? Is the number gone? The number is gone. Okay, now how does this affect our view of the inerrancy of Scripture and the inspiration of Scripture? The number is gone. Nobody knows it. In the world, nobody currently living that I know, and I know all the, a lot of the people that know this stuff, nobody knows this, okay? What's the view of inspiration? Does this affect our view of the inerrancy and inspiration of Scripture? And the answer is no. What does inspiration have to do with? Inspiration has to do with God speaking to the prophet and the prophet writing it down. God speaks to the prophet and the prophet writes it down. Did the prophet write it down well? Yes, he did. What happened? It gets copied over and over and over again. Is this a scribal problem? This is a scribal problem where the scribes, human beings that copied God's word for 1,000 years. So the scribes had problems. Is this a problem in inspiration? No. Inspiration has to do with God speaking to the prophet writing it down. This is a problem of transmission, of scribal problem, of getting copied over and over again. And so this suggests that there are transmission problems in the Bible. Okay? Does God want us worshiping the Bible, or does God want us worshiping Him? So, that's it. And thank you for staying, and have a great Thanksgiving. And greetings to your parents and brothers and sisters, and hope you have a great time over Thanksgiving. All right, take care.
This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his Old Testament History, Literature, and Theology course, lecture number 22, on the book of 1 Samuel, Eli, Samuel, and the selection of Saul as the first king of Israel.